It's time for the WIS Politics Book Club, celebrating Wisconsin authors and books about politics, government, and history.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jeff Maris from WISPolitics.com, and we're doing another session of the WIS Politics Book Club. And today we have in Jack Mitchell. He's the author of Wisconsin on the Air, 100 Years of Public Broadcasting in the State That Invented It. That happens to be Wisconsin. This book is published by the Wisconsin Historical Press, and Jack knows his stuff. He led Wisconsin Public Radio from 1976 till 1997. Welcome, Jack. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing great. So I've got to start off with a very, very serious question that I know a lot of people need to know the answer to about the future of public broadcasting. Will you guys ever get rid of Pledge Week?
Pledge Week? It's Pledge Weeks.
Pledge Week.
it goes on and on and on.
Pledge years.
Yeah. Well, not
keep
quite.
On giving. Keep on giving.
It never stops.
Yes. Well, you know, it puts the public in public broadcasting, perhaps, right? So anyway, Wisconsin on the Air, 100 years of public broadcasting in the state that invented it. I think a lot of people just don't simply know that. About the history and how it started in Wisconsin. So how did you come to write the book? What made you want to document a century's worth of history?
Sure. Well, I was, of course, involved in it for about almost half of that century. I went to the 50th anniversary dinner. I was just a young staff member, but I first joined the staff. That was held in 1969, by the way. Don't do the math.
Okay.
Doesn't
well, I'm not
play.
Good at math either. That's why I went into journalism,
yes.
Jack.
You know. Right. Well, so anyway, so I've experienced it, and I realized that most people who are even those who work in public broadcasting today have little idea of how it developed. And so I knew the last 50 years, and then I decided let's find out the first 50 years. And went back and started researching. And I had a pretty good idea of what this was all about and why it happened. But I was happy to find there were documents out there and records in the State Historical Society and the University Archives that confirmed what I had thought was true. But mm-hmm. in fact, mostly it was.
Well,
we did invent it.
Yes.
We did invent public broadcasting.
Right, and there's a plaque right there on Vilas Hall that says as much, but I students are busy. They walk past, and the people who work there are busy. They walk past.
Know, it's boring, yeah. But the only thing that's it says there that we're the oldest station in the nation. Yeah. That's what the plaque says. I don't quite believe that, but we are certainly the people that invented public radio,
mm-hmm.
That there were other people messing around with radio in those days.
Mm-hmm.
But what's neat here is that the physicists in the science hall on the campus were playing with radio, and they got the thing to work in 1917.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question is, what do we do with it?
Mm-hmm.
And in most places, they just tore it down and built it again next year for another semester of students. And some places they just turned it off, and other places they sold it to a commercial operator. But in Wisconsin, because of the Wisconsin idea, the people said, we can use this to actually do something good.
Mm-hmm.
We can extend the university. We can foster public discussion of issues. We can do all kinds of great things mm-hmm. with this instrument.
I think we forget about the power. Even those who've read history, the power of radio and how powerful a medium it was, before World War II. I mean, can you describe that a little bit?
Well, look, most people in Wisconsin, at least, lived on farms. They were quite isolated. 40% of them were illiterate. People that lived on farms, they couldn't read. They didn't read newspapers. They couldn't. And then this magic thing comes through the air that you could understand.
Mm-hmm.
And it brought the whole world to you. And it extended the universe of people, far beyond what, television was very powerful. But radio had already broken down those barriers. And now people were tied into New York and the rest of the world or London, whatever, through radio. So it just broadened the horizons. And it brought companionship and information to people who had not had it before. There was a homemakers program in the 1930s, And it was said about this woman who did the program that she was actually the best friend of many of these people mm-hmm. because their nearest neighbor was a half mile away. Mm-hmm. And what voice do you hear during the day when you're off by yourself? This person on the radio, and she was very friendly and knowledgeable.
So what was that program? Do you remember what the name of it was?
It was called the Homemakers Program.
Oh, no, the Homemakers Program.
Yeah, well,
okay.
They weren't very imaginative. Oh,
okay, well, that's all right. And so the host would tell people how to can their
beans, and okay. But also how to raise your kids. And she'd read a little poetry. Wow. It was a general education. She was on for 45 minutes.
Now, was she at the university at the time?
Yeah, she was worked in home ec, the home ec department.
Okay, wow. Know,
and she came over and did her show.
So she was extension.
She would have been part of extension. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so we're talking with Jack Mitchell. He's the author of Wisconsin on the Air, 100 Years of Public Broadcasting in the State That Invented It. And it's published by the Wisconsin Historical Press. And I highly recommend it. Jack led Wisconsin Public Radio from 1976 until 1997. So we're talking about the history, the early history. What are, this is like tell a funny joke, but what's something that, you totally just surprised you when you were doing your research? It's like, whoa, I had no idea.
Yeah, well, one of the main things is that back in 1912, this was, a couple of years before radio started, they were proposing that we have non-commercial newspapers, because newspapers that are supported by advertising and subscriptions, mm-hmm. This is inherently corrupt. Therefore, we should have papers that are not-for-profit. And who should run them? Well, maybe universities would be a good idea. This was 1912, but on our campus, President Van Hise was saying these things. Well, not surprising when radio came along 5 years later that they said, well, let's try a non-commercial medium. It mm-hmm. turns out to be radio, not newspapers. But that idea goes way back. It's not new.
Yeah, I had no idea that idea was bouncing around. Well, it's commercialism is kind of crept into public broadcasting as a necessity. I mean, it always seems we joked before about Pledge Week or Pledge Weeks, but why is it that it's so difficult to sustain? Is it because the costs have gone up? Is it because the competition of commercial broadcasting mm-hmm. or will that ever go away? Because it seems to be an ongoing issue.
Sure. Right? Oh, absolutely. Well, of course, the original idea was that there would be no fundraising. It would be tax-supported. The university paid for it for many years. The state directly, and this was the thing that really made Wisconsin different. It wasn't just the university, but the state government, the governor, these people, the legislature, were giving money to educational broadcasting.
Through the biennial budget.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And it was just a service of government, like parks and libraries and anything else. And so that was the key to it. And then when the federal money came along, that was to be tax supported. What happened, though, there are a couple of things. One is that the ambitions started to grow. Mm-hmm. And look, if we had more money, look what we could do. But also the government money didn't grow. And particularly at the federal level, it was never funded the way it was supposed to be. Starting with President Nixon, he cut.
He cut, and it was cut during the Reagan administration.
Reagan administration cut it, too. Nixon was trying to control it.
Mm-hmm.
And Reagan didn't really want to get rid of it or control it. He just didn't want the government paying for it.
Right.
And that's when listener support came in big time. Mm-hmm. Is that, okay, we're not going to support this. Right. Go raise your own money.
Yeah, but it is a way to engage the listener.
I think it's positive.
I think that, the way to you want to support this medium, you give money, you're sort of a part owner.
That's
and you folks have always stressed that. And I think that that's meaningful. For local local broadcasters anywhere, right?
Sure, you bet. And they need to. It causes the staff members to not be so self-indulgent. I've got to read my poems today.
Yeah, right.
Well, people don't care about your poem. You got to do something that somebody's going to care about.
Uh-huh.
And it's hope it's intelligent and all that, but it's not self-indulgent, and we tended to be that way before listener support.
Yes.
There were things on the air that probably shouldn't have been there, but people wanted to do them.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, you know, I noticed throughout the years, I mean, I'm a regular listener, that, you know, when any format changes at all, people complain. You know, it's sort of like, I think it was like they were, one of the later or more recent ones was expanding the news and cutting back on the early classical music.
Early music,
yeah,
yes.
That...
Yep, that,
that
was me.
That created a stir.
Yeah, that was me.
Okay. So, I mean, what sort of, I mean, because, again, people feel ownership in public broadcasting.
You bet.
So, I mean, what was the reaction? Was it like, did you ever think, I'm going to have to back down?
I thought that a few times, but but we knew it was going to happen. I mean, we weren't the first place to do that. And so every place in the country, when Morning Edition replaced classical music, you've got one. You could predict that the morning newspaper is going to object, and they did. Every place, you know, it's nice to have classical music to read your newspaper, but now they're doing news. Fun. So you got that, but also it's a habit, and classical music is nice, but it's a very limited audience, and far more people are interested in the news. And I would say it's probably more important that we provide that kind of news service than soothe people with nice classical music.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you think that, you know, the viewership is viewership? I mean, the listenership has changed over the years. Like, I think, you know, we were a very rural society. Now we're much more urbanized. Do you think that the viewers of the listeners have changed all that much in terms of education? I guess.
Yeah. Well, there are more of them. That's the main thing. Is that the main predictor of listening to public broadcasting is education. The more education you have, the more you're likely to listen. And we have far more educated, highly educated people than we used to. Now, the farm program and the homemaker show, those things appealed to a broader audience than that. But that's the main change, I think, has been that it's more and more focused on people with a reasonable amount of education, or people who maybe not have it but wish they had.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's tied to the university, and that's really central.
Yeah, it makes sense. Okay, so we only have a couple minutes left, and this is a big question, but, you know, let's try to get to the heart of it. I mean, there are real challenges ahead. In your view, what are the real challenges ahead to keep public broadcasting going for another 100 years? I mean, what do you think? Is it just financial? Is it just the changing? Is it the internet? I mean, what are the challenges? What's the big?
Yeah, the technology is a big part of it, because maybe broadcasting won't exist anymore. Maybe people will be listening to podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
You
can do both.
Well, you can, but if you can listen to exactly what you want, whenever you want to do it, why wouldn't you? Instead of sitting there waiting for the good thing to come on.
Right.
So I think broadcasting in general has some threats to it. And public broadcasting would be hurt by that. Well, all broadcasting would be hurt, obviously. But can public broadcasting adapt to this new world, where people are going to be not listening to whatever you give them, but whatever they want to hear at that particular time? And how do you fund that? Right now, we, you know, do pledge drives, and people respond to it. But if it's on a podcast, do you have to go to advertising?
You're right. So it's very narrow cast. That
right.
that so the changing nature of wide. Widespread
yeah.
broadcasting.
Broadcasing is going away.
Yes,
you know, broad audiences.
We're going to narrowcasting, and that is the challenge.
That is very difficult.
Yes. Okay. Well, that's going to wrap it up for us today. This is Jeff Mayers with the WIS Politics Book Club, and I've been talking with Jack Mitchell. He's the author of Wisconsin on the Air: 100 Years of Public Broadcasting in the State That Invented It. So it's a good read, and I can congratulate you, Jack, on a good book.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for stopping by.
Sure.
The WIS Politics Book Club was brought to you by generous sponsors. See them in the archive of these podcasts at wispolitics.com.